What I would like to do in class today is talk about the capital sins. We'll begin with 78, that is obvious. I will only make a few passing references to the pages, assuming you will read them. The lecture proper, the program, calls for an explanation that both underlies your notes and, of course, goes beyond them. We define the capital sins as the inordinate tendencies from which all sins originate as from their source. They are therefore called capital sins, where you know in Latin capita means heads, capita head, capita heads. They are then the sins which are the root or the cause of all other sins in the moral order. When we say they are inordinate tendencies, we affirm that these capital, we call them sins, sinful tendencies, are the result of original sin. Our first parents did not have these inordinate tendencies. Every child of Adam and Eve, therefore, has these seven capital sinful tendencies. In other words, when we speak of somebody as behaving just naturally, that is not, believe me, that is not a compliment. To behave naturally means to be behaving according to one's fallen human nature. St. Paul speaks of these as sins. That's why the church, following St. Paul's teaching, has over the centuries called them the seven capital sins. However, the church has explicitly defined that they are not actual sins as such. They are sins only in the sense that they arise from sin, originally from original sin, and they lead to sin unless they are controlled. They are, therefore, the seven capital drives of our fallen human nature to which all of us, and the word is all of us, are constantly, spontaneously, naturally prone. When do the sinful tendencies begin? At the moment of conception, as more than mother has told me about the child in her womb. And the more children they have, the better they can predict. Father, I know this baby, and they tell you. However, when we say that they originated, these tendencies, where there is no sin, it doesn't mean merely, watch this, it does not mean merely that when our first parents sinned, they somehow set a bad example, scandalized, if you wish, their own offspring over the centuries. This has been, well, the sin transmitted by bad example. That was the heresy of Pelagianism back in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. No. When we say these are sinful tendencies, we mean that when God originally made man, he intended human beings to not have what these tendencies are, one word description for these tendencies, as I'm sure you know, is concupiscence. And the opposite of concupiscence is integrity. So then when we say that they are natural, well, the trouble is, every time we use the word either nature or naturally, as believers, and apply the word nature or natural to human beings, then our faith tells us, unlike, you know, the rest of creation, we have a human nature, and our human nature is natural, all right, but it lacks not qua nature, but qua gift over and above nature that God had originally given to the human race, called the gift of integrity. They go on, 79. What is the basis for the capital sins? As we've just said, it is man's fallen human nature, and watch this, and his own personally induced bad habits or vices. Every child, the moment that child is conceived in his mother's womb, already has these capital sins as sinful tendencies. And what a difference it makes in the raising of children. What a difference to recognize that already in the womb, and surely from birth, my child, I may love the child with all my heart, but my child does have sinful tendencies. And I'm not then blinded my affection for the child by not doing something about those sinful tendencies. I don't give a lecture to a one-year-old on concupiscence. But I do other more effective things. And this, I can tell you, and over the years I've watched mothers on planes, on buses, on trains, and you want to get up and give them a lecture on fallen human nature. I've seen, for example, between father and mother, because it depends on the mother and father, the youngster is acting up, not behaving, and the mother turns the child over to the father. Wonderful. It may not have reached the age of reason, but it does have, well, sense experience. And I've even watched this. A child misbehaving, and the father looks at the child. Things quiet down. But you fathers, be fathers. In other words, fathers are to contribute something to the control of these seven capital sins in their children. That mothers, qua mothers, are not really equipped to do. I know because I lost my father when I was a year old. My mother did what she could, but knowing I was dealing with a mother, oh, how sure you can be at the age of 3, as you mothers know. They would even play the father against the mother, or the mother against the father. Oh, and before the age of reading, oh, they know. What I want to point out from question 79 is that not only do we inherit these sinful tendencies called the seven capital sins from our fallen human nature, But every time we sin, every sin we commit increases, deepens those sinful tendencies. Over the years, as I've said, in counseling souls, unless a person realizes that they have a fallen human nature, and consequently, a nature that is prone to acting in, well, seven capitally sinful ways, people may not realize how indispensable it is if they want to master these sinful drives. They not only are not to give in to the sinful urges we have. Every time we give in, we increase the pressure of these sinful drives. You don't read that in Adler, Freud, or Carl Jung. In other words, this is not merely the acquisition of a habit. As you know, there are two kinds of habits that we acquire by the repetition of an action. If it is a good action that we have performed a certain number of times, we develop a tendency, called a habit, to perform that good action again. Or if it is a bad act, the tendency to perform that bad habit again. It's deeper than that. In other words, unless we first of all know our sinful tendencies, and the bedrock foundation for the spiritual life is knowing among the seven capital sin tendencies, which are the most capital in my life. The two most fundamental are pride and lust. And they're very closely related, indispensably related. As St. Paul, remember, in his letter to the Romans, tells us, because of their pride, these are the Romans, in refusing to acknowledge the one true God, because in their pride, they refuse to submit their wills to the one true God, says St. Paul, therefore God made them slaves of their lusts. So they then were not able to control their sinful, especially sexual drives. And as I reread the history of the Roman Empire in the first centuries of the Christian era, I say to myself, I could just as well be reading the New York Times, the Detroit Free Press, or what's the local Lansing paper? Widespread. We call it paganism. In other words, giving in to these tendencies deepens and increases the urge, until as now, a whole science is developing, claiming that for many people, homosexuality is natural. Sure, it's natural. Sure, it's natural. But my friend, you better define your terms. Because we all have a naturally fallen nature. But And the sooner the giving in to these tendencies starts, all the less control these sinful tendencies are. From the earliest years, I don't mean the age of 4 or 5, from the moment of birth, in fact, even before birth, the emotional conditions of the mother while she's carrying a child, hear it, affects the child in her womb. I repeat, and now that, for what I'm told, correct me if I'm wrong, I've heard on good authority, that in Michigan now, certainly in public schools, that the youngsters are being taught from their earliest years that homophobia is an emotional disorder. Did you know that? That homosexuality is, to repeat the word, natural. My God! But I've got to believe that I've got a fallen nature. Sometimes in teaching the subject, I tell my students, I like to call it the falling nature. We are all leaning towers of Pisa. Except unlike the tower in Pisa, we can fall. Then, number 80. Some of you already know, there is a memory scheme that I found, the only one that I could come up with. Places G. To remember the 7 capital sins. Pride, lust, anger, covetousness, envy, sloth, and gluttony. In other words, our nature, from the origins of the human race, since the fall, is a sinful nature, not only in the sense that when we are conceived, we do not have a right to the beatific vision. That's our faith. And my Jesuit confrere in France, Father Burton de Margerie, had been writing extensively, especially in France, against the abortionists, my saying, and he's right. He says all the other evils of abortion. We are not absolutely sure, not really sure, that an unborn, unbaptized child will see the face of God. Maybe in God's mercy, but we don't know. Killing that unborn child deprives it of the prospect of being baptized and therefore of the certitude of reaching the vision of God. However, baptism, how this needs to be underlined, baptism does indeed restore the supernatural gifts that our first parents received when they were first made by God. Sanctifying grace is restored, and that means the indwelling Holy Spirit. That means the infused theological virtues. It means the infused gifts of the Holy Spirit. All of those are restored by baptism. What is not restored is either the gift of integrity, which means the built-in, divinely built-in control of our sinful drives. That is not restored. Concupiscence remains. The 7 capital sinful tendencies remain, baptized or not. When then we say, and these are the result of the fall, we should also add that God must have had a profound reason, first for allowing our first parents to sin in the first place, but then for allowing us to inherit these sinful tendencies. And by the way, a good synonym for the seven capital sins is the seven passions. Seven human passions to which every human being is spontaneously prone. Why, we may ask, has God allowed us to have these sinful tendencies? There must have been, in God's both goodness and wisdom, must have been a reason, a profound reason for allowing it. There is. First of all, whatever else God wants us to be, He wants us to be humble. And no matter what other people may think of us, what pedestals they may put us on, we know better. We know, down deep in our hearts, each one of us, the sinful drives that I've got, and except for the grace of God, there is no criminal on earth that every one of us could not either have become, or unless we watch ourselves, can become. To keep us humble. Secondly, this is over the centuries, the masters of the spiritual life, reflecting on why we have these seven capital sins. In order that, realizing we cannot, and the verb is we cannot control these passions by ourselves. We cannot. That's why 99.5% of sex education in the United States is not only a deception, but what word shall I use and be charitable? An awesome evil perpetrated on the young. Take, for example, the New Creation Sex Education series in use in many dioceses. As I'm sure you know, the Archbishop of Dubuque gave the imprimatur for the whole series. A lot of opposition, and only God knows what happened in Rome. But if you read the letters carefully, Cardinals Baum and Ratzinger, they didn't really approve the new creation. And all the Catholic papers in the country, blazing headlines, Vatican approves the new creation. They didn't. My job is working for them. But, and by the way, I could provide all of you with a copy of what I wrote to the Holy See on their request, the analysis of the New Creation series. I could not publicly identify myself with the refutation of the New Creation series. For many reasons. The Holy See wanted me to get bishops, Catholic organizations to sponsor the refutation. Not one was willing to do so. Not one. Shall we? This is part of the course. Comes in two parts. together, I think about, I'm guessing, about 25 or so pages of closely reasoned analysis. Spend 4 months analyzing everything. And the one thing is just simply messy. It is that in terms of lust, second capital, sinful tendency, the fact that we have this urge, lustful urge, all of us, that we cannot control that without God's grace. As though we didn't have a fallen human nature. You just don't. And you want to destroy that chastity of your children. You just don't do that. As I told one mother general of an almost 2,000 member community in the East, where the diocese said they were to use a new creation series. I said, Mother, in God's name, don't do it. But the Archbishop said that we should. You tell him I told you, you're not going to do it. She thought she'd be disobedient. Well, she was disobedient, all right, to the will of God. And I told you, I promise you, or threatened you, your sisters will not be able to maintain the vow of chastity if they teach this course to the children. This is all, by the way, apropos. It's not theory, believe me. Now we'll go down, and I'd like to finish all seven capital sins before, let's see, I go to, who knows the time that I'm supposed to speak?
125.
Please?
125.
125. 125. How much? 225. I can hardly believe it. Are you sure? Here goes.
We have 1 hour left.
So we're back on page 23, asking ourselves, what is pride? Pride is the inordinate desire for one's own excellence. First of all, are we to have a recognition of our own excellence? Are we to recognize the goodness, the virtue, the intelligence that we have? Is there anything wrong with knowing that, well, pardon me, I'm intelligent, or that I can sing, which I can't? No. The key word is inordinate. When is the desire for one's own excellence, or the desire for recognition, whatever terms you use, when is this inordinate? When I want, first of all, to recognize my own excellence, I want others to recognize it too. Is that wrong? No. It is wrong when and insofar as I credit myself for what I am and have. In other words, the sin of pride is not in recognizing one's possessions, whether physical, intellectual, social, or spiritual. What is wrong when and insofar are is I fail to give God the credit for everything that I am and have. And that is when Our Lady's Magnificat is the perfect prayer or hymn for humility. My soul magnifies whom? The Lord. What do poor people do? They magnify, well, what else? Themselves. And will often not only not give credit to God. They won't even ask children give credit to their parents. What's the remedy for pride? Sincere knowledge of oneself, especially shades of today's homily, especially one's own sinfulness. Ah, that's why God has allowed us to sin. And hear it. The higher the sanctity He wants to call us to, the more He has allowed us to sin in the past. There are exceptions. There are. But that is the more common rule. St. Paul had to be the hounder and even murderer of Christians, then converted, came to his senses and became the zealous apostle of Gentiles. Peter, while Christ wanted to make sure that no one had any doubt that popes are very common, very human beings. Meditation on the humility of Christ. But watch this. In theology, we speculate. How would anybody answer? Sister, would you think? Was Christ ever humiliated? You think He was? Well, I should say, we speculate in theology whether He was. In one sense, of course, condemned to death, scourged, stripped of His garments, nailed to the cross. What greater humiliation, you might say. But if humiliation is inside of one, then the question arises. And there are good grounds for saying, no. Christ chose to be what we call humiliated. But in His own eyes, He wanted it. And this, in my 50 years in the Society of Jesus, and by now having given so many spiritual exercises to the faithful, I tell them, Christ's humility is not only an inspiration for us to accept, resign ourselves to being humiliated, but even hear it, provided we know it's God's will, we even prefer what is humiliating to that which is, in the eyes of others, elevating. Because Christ chose, He wanted to be humiliated. Prayer for humility. And I found over the years, you've got to get into the habit. The moment you're humiliated, and the variety is almost infinite of being humiliated. Either in the presence of others, sometimes the worst humiliation is when nobody else is around. How many times I've told myself, Harden, you idiot. And I meant it. You idiot. I would recommend, and all it takes is a moment. The moment you are humiliated, immediately say a prayer. It can be as simple as, "Thanks, Jesus." Thanks, Jesus. I may not want to say it. Gratitude for the humiliations. Or when, for example, how often this happens. Telephone call. As soon as they hear the voice, this will call for above average humility. I don't talk out loud. Sometimes I put my hand over the over the earphone. But to ask for the grace to take it. That is, that I receive. And the more exposed you are publicly, believe me, more humility you have to have, because people are so eager to humiliate anyone who is thought well of by someone else. Oh, by the way, this leaflet, about 1.25 million in circulation. Well, someone gave me a copy of a recent issue of The Remnant. Have you heard about The Remnant? I think the editor is the son of Al Matt, who broke with his father, Al Matt being the editor of the Wanderer magazine. In any case, The Remnant had two columns on Father Hardin. Good man, but how naive can you be? Does he really think what America is he living in? That we're going to get leaders in our country who will respect the sanctity of unborn human life, sanctity of marriage, sanctity of marital relations. Sanctity of marital relations. What are you talking about? Sanctity of the family. Sanctity of the aging. In other words, they just, the writer just threw in the sponge. And no, they're asking for a miracle. And we may need a miracle in next week's elections. We may need it. But whether we have an election which will now then, in the highest authority in the country, support the very opposite of what we've just said. We've got massive conversion work. That's what these classes are about, right? The reconversion of America. Just a word about vainglory. Vainglory is a lower grade of pride. It is the inordinate desire to manifest one's own excellence in order to be praised by others. When the praise is sought for some earthly things. And as you know, people will go to all kinds of lengths. The last figure of the cosmetic industry in the United States, and it's much higher now, was $7 billion a year. In other words, to be praised. Wives tell me their husbands want them to. Well, Father, the money I spend, the time I give at the mirror. Now, a wife should be attractive to her husband. You know what I mean. So much so that people work in the hairdressing industry. I've counseled some of them. They can do a lot of good counseling to the women to help them in their spiritual life, especially with their humility. Now, the sequence that I have here in this, call it, catechism of moral theology, does not follow the sequence for the places G. You follow me? So suppose we turn to the logical next one, number 88, lust. We define lust as the inordinate desire for sexual pleasure. Let's make sure we know there is no sin in sexual pleasure per se. There is no sin in the desire for sexual pleasure. As with pride, so with lust. The sin is in the inordinacy. And when we speak of something being inordinate, the word behind the inordinate is the word order. An order. Order in theological terms. Order is the right means being taken to achieve a good end. The right means being taken to achieve a good end. There's order. Back then, to sexual pleasure. In the mind of God, does sexual pleasure have a good end? Indeed. Indeed. Later on, among the capital sins is gluttony. And gluttony is again the inordinate desire for food and drink. Is it a sin to eat or drink? Does eating and drinking have a good end? Yes. Otherwise, well, we wouldn't be here if we hadn't eaten for, say, at least the last 2 weeks. So that just as for the preservation of the individual person, God has a built-in desire for the preservation of the human race. And therefore, sexual pleasure, and the moment you use these words, all kinds of connotations, which our modern world, of course, associates with these words. So, no, sexual pleasure is a gift from God. What's the end? The reproduction of the human race. Is that the only end? No. For the fostering of the mutual love between husband and wife. But you better add between husband and wife. So that the inordinacy is what makes lust lust. And this is where living, as we know, in the most sex-saturated society in human history, no question about it. To understand, I went on to cover the capital sins in the present lecture. We won't go into further detail. So,